Golly, Catherine. Well, that doesn't change the fact that you're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5. Oh, there's more music.
I'm going to leave that on
in the background and let you listen to that. This is Freedom Cry by Deep Forest.
Mulți boioc odiși drept în vai. Coran grețial, fel de archip de consigra.
And good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, teacher, writer, cool person, Carlos Hernandez. And a movie review? And stuff. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. The conceit of the new comedy Moonwalkers is that in the summer of 1969, a CIA operative played by Ron Perlman travels to London to recruit Stanley Kubrick to stage a fake moon landing. This is based on an actual conspiracy theory, by the way. A dumb conspiracy theory, but a real one, nevertheless. Through an unconvincing series of mishaps, the agent winds up partnering with a failed rock manager played by Rupert Grint and hiring a group of stoned-out hippies to pull off the scam. Here's the problem with that. If you're planning on filming a satirical comedy, it's probably best not to invoke the name of the director of one of the greatest satirical films of all time, that name being Kubrick, of course, that film being Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Not unless you can really bring it. And director Antoine Bardou-Jacquet, sorry, cannot. Bardou-Jacquet seems to realize this. The Kubrick aspect lasts only as long as it takes to get Perlman's agent to the hippie compound. There are sporadic attempts to visually reference such films as Dr. Strangelove and A Clockwork Orange, but that's as committed as the film gets. There's no real attempt to try to imagine the full implications of the scenario. Then it's dropped completely. Even when you think an acid trip sequence might lend itself to quoting 2001 A Space Odyssey or the invasion of armed CIA agents on British soil, mind, might invite some nods to Full Metal Jacket or Dr. Strangelove again. That's a disappointment, because the idea of Kubrick faking the moon landing or of a group of con artists scamming the US into thinking Kubrick is directing the moon landing could lend itself to some supreme farce, giving Kubrick's notoriety the same notoriety that makes it patently ridiculous that he'd ever participate in such a scam. Given that time of Nixonian paranoia, there are lots of comedic opportunities there. Doesn't happen with Moonwalkers. Mired as it is in cliché, talented as Perlman is, there's only so much he can do with a character whose primary beat is to be approached by some guy asked, "Who the hell are you?" and respond by punching him square in the face. And as unambitious as the film is in its comedy, best laugh happens when Perlman, recovering from a drug trip and facing imminent failure of his plan, declares, "Not on my watch," glances at his wrist and says, "Where the hell's my watch?" That's as good as it gets. Director Bardou-Jacquet does make that acid trip visually distinctive. I doubt anyone ever taking acid has seen a giant spider composed of other smaller spiders, but it is a cool image. But overall, Moonwalker takes an intriguing invitation to comedy and does little with it. By the way, more successful in its out-there sensibilities, even if it isn't really genre, is the Brazilian action film Two Rabbits. This is another amped-up Tarantino-esque exercise about a low-level hood who stages the robbery of a crime boss, both as an act of revenge and redemption. And while director Afonso Poyar's energetic helming can cause problems, among other things the fractured timeline tends to obscure as often as it illuminates, it is still a frenetic and fun reworking of the heist film. But instead of that, maybe you just want to spend some time catching up on the Oscar nominees. My life being what it is, I haven't seen any of the non-genre Best Picture nominees, but I do hope to catch up at least to The Big Short and maybe The Revenant. I've been hearing a lot about that for months now. Of the two genre nominees for Best Picture, The Martian isn't too much of a surprise. It's epic, it's uplifting, and it admittedly has a spectacular closing sequence. As for Mad Max Fury Road, I had problems with the film, I did with Martian as well, but I have to say I'm happy to see something so idiosyncratic and energetic on the list. That's a surprise in a pleasant way. I don't think either one stands much chance of taking the gold. It appears The Revenant is in the best position for that. But of the two, if I had to choose, I'd say The Martian is more likely. But don't go betting on it, just on my word. The bigger surprise comes in the animated feature category, which in past years has tended to weight in favor of big studio releases, whether they deserved it or not. But this year only gives that nod to Pixar's Inside Out, with the other slots going to more exotic offerings, ranging from the still somewhat mainstream Shaun the Sheep movie out of Aardman Animation, and thence to Studio Ghibli's Ghost Story When Marnie Was There, the heartbreaking Brazilian film Boy and the World, and Charlie Kaufman's radical stop-motion character study Anomalisa. Shaun the Sheep is the only one I haven't seen. Of the others, When Marnie Was There was the most disappointing. Studio Ghibli just going through the motions, albeit lovely motions. Boy and the World and Anomalisa, however, are both well-deserving of the award. It's more than likely, though, that Inside Out is going to win. And no complaints there. It is a fantastic film. It is heartening to see the animation category resisting industry pressures and elevating more original efforts. This category is never a stranger to that, but it's just a stronger slate this year. And talk about daring. I should note that iconoclastic animator Don Hertzfeldt's latest animated short, The Stone-Faced Dystopic Comedy World of Tomorrow, has been nominated in Best Animated Short. I'd love to see him win, although he really should have taken it in 2001 for Rejected. But still, as they say, it's an honor to be nominated, isn't it? Okay, and just one more thing. Let me just say that the Special Effects Award should probably go to Ex Machina for its eerie realization of Alicia Vikander's see-through android body. But it will likely go to Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens, because that's the consolation prize for not being nominated in any of the major categories. Awarding excellence, year after year. Star Wars effects are just fine, really they are. I'm not knocking them. It's just, you know, Oscars. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com.
Thank you, Daniel. One of those two. Take your choice, parse it, and that's the one that I intended to say. And good morning. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. My name is Jim Freund. This is Hour of the Wolf, and we have a wonderful guest this morning, and so I'm going to start with a major downer. But before, let us say hi to Carlos Hernandez.
Hi, Dad.
You know what? Pull the mic close to you rather than, yeah.
Okay. Hi.
Yeah, that's much better.
There we go.
There we go. Much better. And I know if it isn't much better, Kathy will come in. Yeah, I used to be a major engineer here and knew everything. This place, I am for Schlunget. Okay, last week, and we'll tell you all about Carlos very shortly, other than you need to know about this person. And now, at long last, you can buy a book.
Yay!
Or at least in a week or so.
Yeah, pre-order now, 25th, it's out into the world.
And the title is?
The Assimilated Cuban's Guide to Quantum Santeria.
Very good. Very good. And we're, of course, going to get a definition for those. I had to look up Santeria. I didn't read the whole book because I got a PDF, and a PDF on a little phone is very teensy little. But I've read a number of the stories and heard you read a couple of them already.
Exactly. You have been exposed to many of the stories in there. Yeah.
Yes, very much so. And we'll get into that in a moment. But if you listened to the program last week, you know that since there wasn't a preordained guest, I took the opportunity to play the music of David Bowie. And this was a necessity. I had not realized until I started just how important Bowie was, not only to American culture and all that, and world culture, but specifically to science fiction culture. You know, Space Oddity was not an oddity. He had that. He had Starman on his very early albums from Duran, which are not available on any place other than the streaming service that I happen to be using. We pulled up Please, Mr. Grave Digger, a lovely, nasty little three-minute play, basically. It's not even a song. My favorite of The Laughing Gnome, which is nothing but like British music hall bad puns about a gnome in the background. And he's saying, oh, say here, what is that? That's my brother Fred. Why is he clucking? He's a metronome. And just, you know, bad, silly, British music hall humor. Bowie could go anywhere. And he did. Yeah. He is a man who the New York Times pointed out walked all around New York. He was a New Yorker, lived in New York, could go anywhere. Nobody would recognize him because he wasn't wearing the red pink hair. He didn't land in a spider ziggy thing and stuff like that. He was among his last works as a playwright. He did a show that's currently running. It was scheduled to close next week. Somehow I don't think it's going to do that at the New York Theater Workshop called Lazarus, which if Bowie was fine, if he was great and healthy, that show would run a year because it's just gotten – it's a variant on The Man Who Fell to Earth, a little closer to Bowie's vision than the movie was, which he did not direct, but he did have a great deal to do with shaping, same way that he helped shape Labyrinth, even though Labyrinth was written by Terry Jones. But when they got Bowie in, because, you know, who knew Jennifer Connelly in whatever year that was, that they wanted a name, and Bowie was, I think he added a lot to the movie, even though it wasn't exactly what Terry Jones had in mind. And, okay, so that's Bowie. That's last week. Not long ago, WBAI lost one of my favorite people here, Simon Lokely. And we're still playing his programs, at least through his memorial will be on February 22nd, which would have been his next, lecture at the Hibernian Swift, the first... the third Monday of every month. It's kitty corner from the KGB bar where they do wonderful readings. And locally would hold court there, except during the winter months. And Simon died in December. And his next event at the Swift would have been on February 22nd. Only problem is the Hibernian Lounge, like KGB, won't hold more than 75 people or so. And there are many hundreds of his devoted listeners. When I preceded him, I was on 5 to 7, he was on 7 to 9. So you must have met him, Carlos. You wouldn't remember, but when you were on the show with Delia, you would have met him. And he locally took the high road. He discussed Herman Melville, James Joyce, this and that. And then he'd play Sinatra. Not just Sinatra. He'd play crappy Sinatra. Sorry, Simon. I would love to be able to have you here to have an argument with you about it. But the Capitol years, I like Sinatra the jazz singer, not Sinatra singing Old MacDonald Had a Chick. We've had this argument on the air, and I'll find the air check of it and play it so I can have it with him again anyway. That started a horrible, horrible, horrible spate of people who have died. And looking up just some names that I knew, not including a lot of names that I didn't know, Mitch Cohn was here. He mentioned a major Marxist philosopher, economist who I never heard of. Dale Griffin of Mott the Hoople, for whom Bowie wrote All the Young Dudes. He was the drummer, but he was one of the founders. Glenn Frey of the Eagles. Am I the world's biggest Eagles fan? No, but The Journey of the Sorcerer from one of the Eagles albums is the intro and outro music of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and is a lovely tune. And because of that, I've listened to some other Eagles stuff and went, hey, that wasn't bad. And I liked him as an actor and wise guy. Brian Bedford, wonderful stage actor. Everything from Henry V to playing Lady Bracknell in The Importance of Being Earnest. A fabulous actor. Alan Rickman. Forget Harry Potter. I mean, don't, but forget Harry Potter. Alan Rickman was a playwright, a director, an actor's actor, a la, you know, Alec Guinness or Katharine Hepburn, people who really understood the trade. And if you want to go lowbrow, yeah, who else could have given Snape that gravitas? And for that matter, by the way, Gravity Quest. But a lot, check out a movie called Bottle Rocket, fun movie with Chris Pine, all about how the Californians won the award for best wine away from France. Wonderful period movie and allegedly true story. And Rickman was a good playwright. Truly, Madly, Deeply, a movie that Rickman, I think, wrote and directed. As well. A little known film involves ghosts, so hardcore genre? No, but then what is? Who cares? It was good writing. Richard Libertini, a character actor that nobody knows, but the moment you see him, you go, oh, him! Yeah, in the movie Ghost, he inhabited the subways and threw ghosts he didn't like off by yelling at them. He played a swami in the movie All of Me, moving Lily Tomlin into Steve Martin's body and stuff like that. Small roles, which are the cornerstone of the 150-something movies that he was in. Look him up, see the picture, you'll know. Natalie Cole, part of an empire, part of a legacy of family. Otis Clay, one of the great singers. Pierre Boulez, one of the great conductors of classical music. Not to be confused with anybody named Boulez, is Pierre Boulez. Of many philharmonics. He was in his 80s. Pat Harrington, another wonderful character actor. Carlos, you remembered him from what TV show?
One Day at a Time.
One Day at a Time, where he was the janitor, right?
Yeah, with the cigarettes rolled up in his sleeve. Schroeder,
yeah,
I think
yeah,
his name
yeah.
is.
My favorite role of his is a movie you don't know that I recommend to everybody called The President's Analyst. The title says it all. James Coburn is the president's shrink. Analysts and all that in the late 60s. And of course, he knows all the secrets. So everybody, including the CIA and the FBR, are out to kill him. But all during this, as is typical in spy movies of that era, there is a third party that nobody knows is there who are really the bad guys. And they are known as, how do they term it? Is it, yeah, TTC. No, TPC. TPC. What is TPC? Well, it's run by Pat Harrington, who is, by the way, a robot. And they are the phone company. And when you watch the last 15 minutes of the movie and they tell you about how everybody will be able to be located by their phone company any point whatsoever, 1967 movie people. Okay? It's like, what do you call TPC today? It's Google and Verizon and Apple. It's here, man. That wasn't a science fiction film at all. That's my favorite Pat Harrington role. Robert Stigwood, RSO Records. Robert Stigwood Organization founded a band called the Bee Gees and did a lot of good and a lot of bad stuff. Vilmos Zsigmond, one of the great cinematographers of all time, did some movie called 2001, A Space Odyssey, and many other films. And yet, the science fiction world was shaken yesterday by the death of David G. Hartwell. Dave, the if Now, I had a nice little thing all set up for this, and of course, I've lost it because it does get emotional. But if John W. Campbell reigned over the science fiction world from the late 30s through the late 50s, and then you have the Digest era where there's no one figure looming over everything, maybe as editors, H.L. Gold and Fred Pohl and FNSF. Anthony Boucher, who, by the way, moonlighted when he was the editor of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction as music director of WBAI until his death in 1963. And so they held reign for a while. But in the 60s came this guy at NAL. I knew him starting when he was at NAL, New American Library, which I think included Signet books. And I saw this guy walking around, Lunacon or something like that, quite happily inebriated, holding a bottle in one hand and a briefcase in the other, going into a room party. Goes into the room party. People aren't looking at the bottle. They're looking at the briefcase. He opens it up, and he starts handing out free books. He was everybody's favorite friend immediately. I don't know the number of writers who Dave brought to the fore in... And I don't think it's necessarily that many. What he fostered were editors. The people who he brought in, like Beth Meacham, and when he was at NAL, people working with him included Terry Bisson. His boss at the time was a woman that nobody would know, Carolyn Fireside, who was quite a firebrand. She passed away about a year and a half ago, and I knew her only because I did tech support for her, but she was actually quite a power, and boy, did she have stories to tell about Hartwell. Unfortunately, she preceded him, about the same age, too. And I think that he helped hire people like Ginger Buchanan, who for many years held the reins at Berkeley Ace. At one point, Hartwell worked for Berkeley Ace, and he would often hire his successor. And that successor would be a person who would then define that line of books. And those lines of books would help define writers. Science fiction would not be what it is today if not for David Hartwell, with very forward-thinking, very brilliant fantasy, hard science fiction. He edited a great many anthologies, including A Century of Hard SF, with his ex-wife, Catherine Kramer. Ex-wife now, not at the time they did the book. He was an editor of one of the better Best of the Year anthologies. Listeners call up, they say, well, I don't know science fiction, but I like what I hear on your show. What should I read? Answer. Read the Best of the Year books. And read the honorable mentions in the back of those, the ones done by Gardner Dozois and Ellen Datlow and David G. Hartwell. We're going to have to do a whole show on this, more than one. He was a founder and creator of the New York Review of Science Fiction, the magazine. He also had a magazine called The Little Magazine, which he worked on with Baird Searles, who was the drama and literature director when I worked here. There was a time when Hartwell and Thomas M. Dish, no, Chip Delaney, Hartwell, Samuel R. Delaney, and Margot Adler, she of Hour of the Wolf, were all serving jury duty together. And boy, did I want to be a fly on that wall. They're not just serving jury duty together, they were on the same jury. I would go down and meet them for lunch every day. It was amazing. That was in the early 70s. So, 2016 has so far, in terms of the culture, the people that we have lost, has really sucked, folks. And if I was going to invoke a Carlin word, it would be number three on the list of great hits. It's number three'd up. It's totally three'd up. Okay? You know, now you've got to go look that up. Look up the seven Carlin words, and then you will have it. Otherwise, the FCC would hand my number eight to me of the seven words. Arse. There's my rant for the morning. I'm sorry, Carlos. All this preamble took half an hour.
No, I mean, it's really important to do, especially, you know, for people just to know that these people have passed, and especially someone like Hartwell, with whom you've had such a long relationship. Like you said, you're going to have to do a couple of shows, I think, to
several. And when I mentioned, by the way, the New York Review of Science Fiction, aside from the KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series, is the New York Review of Science Fiction Reading Series, which I took over. It is a misnomer that David started it, by the way. A few people have been putting that into obits. Gordon Van Gelder started it. Gordon was working for, there's another editor that David helped foster. And Gordon started the reading series and passed it on to about eight or nine people in succession. And I got it about 11 or 12 years ago and haven't let go quite yet. And let me just mention, by the way, Groundhog Day. And since it's that day, let me say it again. Groundhog Day. Got to say it twice. Our readers will be Richard Bose and Barbara Krasnoff. Two people, this will be a decent segue, who have been in a writer's group with Carlos Hernandez.
That's right, the Tabula Rasa group. In fact, the story that I'm going to read today was one of the stories that I began drafting back then.
You know,
it took a long time, actually, to develop into the story it is now. But yeah.
Well, was it then the Tabula Rasa group, or was it the 8th of February? It had two names.
It was Tabula Rasa.
It was, okay, yeah. Yeah.
It was the Tabula Rasa group at that point, yeah.
Yeah, the original people who then subsequently moved out of town or got too busy called it the 8th of February. Why, by the way, you ask? That's Jules Verne's birthday.
Ah, excellent. The story that Barbara has in Clockwork Phoenix 5, Sabbath Wine, was one of the ones that I read as part of Tabula Rasa.
So now we're
anthology buddies in Clockwork Phoenix 5.
So, yes, and both of you will be reading at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings on April 5th.
That's right. Yeah.
As Clockwork Phoenix 5 launches, and we're going to have eight people reading. That's something I try to avoid. That's what I call that a datlo. Because Ellen, what she does is she brings in all of these famous, wonderful people, and they're all going to read a snippet of their fiction so that you get a good taste, a nice snort of what they are. That's, by the way, referring to what people do with wine when you open a fresh bottle. A good sniff of what these people are writing. I tend to go for complete short stories, but this is Clockwork Phoenix, which is one of the premier original anthology series that are left. There was a time when they were a dime a dozen, and now they're like, you know, about $15 for two or three. Right. There aren't that many. And Clockwork Phoenix only comes out, what, about every 2 years?
Something like that. I mean, you know, Mike Allen has to, you know, well, he chooses to fund through Kickstarter. And so,
right,
you know, it's all the energy that has to go into a successful Kickstarter campaign in order to, you know, generate the funds to make it possible.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm still trying to do a Kickstarter for the Nurse of Readings. So, and it is so time-consuming, I haven't been able to make a start at it.
Yeah, it takes a lot of work, but yeah, I mean, I'm on the air. I will help you. I've helped with many campaigns.
Okay, well, I will ask you and Alex Schwartzman.
No, I'm pretty good.
And Margot Atwell. I've been talking to her. I always hesitate over her name because it's too much like Margot Adler. And every time I get an email from Margot Atwell, who has been on this program, she was on about 3 or 4 months ago. Ooh, have to have her her significant other on, Zach Zeiss, because he has a book out, a science fiction book, and all that. So, yeah, it's his turn coming up. Anyway. Tell us a little bit about yourself. You're from the old neighborhood.
Well, I live in Regal Park in Queens.
You're in Regal Park. Okay, you moved.
No, you. I think you just so wanted me to be from Jackson Heights.
I specifically knew about what block you were on in Jackson Heights.
I think we talked about my neighborhood at one point, and I'm not sure what happened in the interim, but yeah.
Maybe you had a neighbor who I knew who was also in Jackson Heights.
Possibly. I mean,
I had a number of people from Cuban backgrounds who were all friends from when I was a cashier at the Rainbow Room.
So, yeah, I mean, I certainly know Jackson Heights, and it's part of the sort of like larger Queens stomping ground. But there is a
large Cubano community there. It's basically you walk through Jackson Heights. If the food smells fabulous, you're near 74th Street, and that's the Indian food. If you're near where I grew up, when I was a kid, it was the Russian-German smells of food. Isaac Asimov lived near there, as did Willie Ley, until Asimov moved to Manhattan. But if you go to this other part that's like in the upper 60s, right near the BQE, that's a large Cuban a mini neighborhood, and you can tell it's the Cuban neighborhood because I hate to throw things like this around and categorize people, but because they all grow the most beautiful flowers in front of their houses. The Cubans have green thumbs. Well, and good food.
It's definitely true of my dad, you know, and there was, you know, at the time of immigration, you know, there was just a huge population of farmers who came over, and people who even weren't farmers were still farming. And so that seems to me, you know, at least a likely scenario. I don't know if I could characterize, I mean, I certainly don't, although I'm doing better. I'm growing a butchalokia plant, you know, so I can just burn my own brains out with hot peppers now. And it's doing,
oh, there you go. Okay,
it's doing fantastically well. And so I'm extremely proud of myself. And I hope my dad is too.
Okay. Well, off the air, I'll ask what you're cooking with it, but.
Mostly my brain.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know, it's just...
I cook my brain with other things, but I love spicy food, so and I love Cuban food. So one of the great things about working at the Rainbow Room is that the waiters cooked their own meals. You know, the executive staff ate what the diners ate. And I was technically, as a cashier, executive staff, but I generally... You know, I got the Ecuadorian food today, the Peruvian food that day, the Portuguese food that day, which not the Brazilian. That's different. Don't get those people confused. And the Cuban food. So that's simply about background and also, right. Like me, assimilation, because... Jackson Heights, and that's probably another reason I was thinking of you in Jackson Heights. Yeah. But it's also true of Rego Park, are both neighborhoods of assimilation.
Yeah, and I mean, many, many neighborhoods in Queens, I think, are like that. There are places where, knock on whatever fake
whatever
this
is. Yeah.
Yeah, the housing stays a little more affordable, and, you know, it's...
Being WBAI, it's probably knock on balsa, you know?
But it is, you know, it's a wonderfully diverse, you know, place to be in. I mean, I really like Queens. I do. I'm very much a Queens boy.
Yeah, so do I. But there was a time when Jackson Heights was run into the ground by drugs.
Oh, yeah.
And it was allowed to run into the ground. That's a whole other story. So that money of South American terrorists like the Shining Path could be traced as it went through the U.S. Hmm. So they didn't make busts. And that was my conspiracy theory until I was told by a cop friend of mine who was in direct knowledge to know that, yes, this is true. And the New York Times covered how New York City sued the feds to return Jackson Heights to its former self.
Hmm.
So that was an, but aside. So, but in that time, I moved out. And became a Brooklynite,
mm-hmm.
where we are now.
Where you are now, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, literally, we're on Atlantic Avenue here.
So I'm a City University of New York professor.
Which is our last location, except that different campus.
Different campus, yeah. I'm an associate professor at the Borough of Manhattan Community College, and I also have an appointment at the Graduate Center as part of the Interactive Technology and Pedagogy program there. And yeah. So, you know, I do, you know, the things that you would expect a college English professor to do. I teach a lot of composition. I teach science fiction. I'm teaching science fiction.
Are you really?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, one of the things I was going to ask you off air, but now I'll just put pressure on you on air. Yeah. See if I can get you into the classroom this semester.
Yeah, try to drag me out of there. That's the problem. I'd love it.
But yeah, so I teach creative writing a lot, and sometimes I'll teach at the Graduate Center as well. And you know, I earned my tenure by writing many of the stories that are appearing now in the short story collection that's coming out.
Which is, again?
It's called The Assimilated Cuban's Guide to Quantum Santeria.
And it's published by Rosarium Publishing. What is Santeria?
Well, it's a religion. And so it's a religion that was created by the slaves based on the religion Yoruba. And what it was that slaves who were brought to Cuba were not allowed to practice their religion, but they could be Catholic. They could practice Catholicism. And so they took the Catholic saints and basically practiced their own religion by making use of the Catholic saints. And so Santa Barbara became the representation of Xangô because they shared similar color schemes. You know, Xangô was often featured in red. And so the red of Santa Barbara, and Santa Barbara has a sword, and Xangô's male, but he's very much a trickster as well. And so, you know, he would think it's kind of funny, you know,
you can't have a proper religion without a trickster.
Well, certainly, you know, Santeria covers it through Xangô. And so, you know, basically different saints became the houses, you know, for the different representations from the Yoruba culture. And that's the way that it's propagated. And so it's very much an oral tradition, a religion of oral tradition. And it has, you know, evolved and spread throughout the Caribbean and Central and South America, especially, and into the United States. I think I remember reading that there may be up to something like 100 million practitioners, you know, throughout all the various countries where it's represented now. So
wow.
It's quite large, but not so centralized, you know. And so this is one of the places where you get a lot of local variants, and it's a religion that is born of, you know, adjusting, assimilation, of modifying and insisting on its own existence. And so, you know, I think it's a powerful, scrappy religion. You know, it's a religion that just will not go away.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Santeria has, you know, many, many practices that it inherits from its Yoruban culture, but there are many local variations and different ways to practice. Even in the States, when, you know, I've encountered Santeria from family members or from other people in the community, there would be debates between, you know, there would be two people who were talking about it and two people having two different ideas of how to conduct, you know, business in the religion. And so the differences were already beginning to appear even in those small sorts of groups. And it's one of the reasons why it became such an important metaphor for me and sort of understanding how religion works and how the esoteric can become universal, but also how the universal can kind of break back down into esoterica once you get down to the level of the individual.
Mm-hmm. And therefore quantum Santeria?
That specifically...
I mean, this is specifically for those people who are saying, okay, these are two words that you generally don't see next to each other.
Right. And so that comes from the premise of the story. The story is told by a quantum physicist who has an encounter with the practices of Santeria that he simply can't explain. And so, you know, the quantum Santeria is really representative of Salvador's specific story, and you know, the fact that he's grown up to be a scientist, but when he was a kid, he had this experience that he had no way to explain, and that you know, came much through his father, and his father being a former Santero, and once the father's wife, his Sal's mother, dies, then it's a moment where he has to sort of try to reclaim his roots, figure out who he is, and he goes back to practicing Santeria, which his son is very interested in.
Okay. Gaming.
Yes. So
one word there. I knew that would set you off.
Yeah. I'm an avid gamer. I'm a writer on a video game right now, and so I have been the lead writer and one of the game designers on a game called Merryweather, which is about the Lewis and Clark expedition. It's going to be a computer role-playing game. It's in beta right now, and you know, in you know, a matter of, I hope, you know, maybe just a couple of months, it's going to be released out into the ether. I also, as part of my teaching, I've been involved in game-based learning for, you know, I think since 2008 now. And so on Friday, the CUNY Games Festival is going on, which is this national conference where people come together to talk about ways in which they incorporate the best practices from games and use them to improve pedagogy. And there's a great deal of research that's being done on this right now. It's a burgeoning field. And so, you know, the basic idea is that games have to be, by definition, great, great teachers. That is, for the fun of a game to happen, you have to learn the rules, learn them quickly, and then be excited by putting rules into practice. So games are experts at teaching themselves in the process of creating the fun of them. So the idea is, okay, let's see if games then, because they can do this, can be used just flat out in the classroom. And you know, it's an interesting field. It's you know, some things that you would think are intuitive are not necessarily true. One I was involved in a study in 2012 of about 400 BMCC students, and one of the things that we found is that the more academically successful student was, the more likely they were to benefit from game-based learning, which in a way was not quite what we were hoping for. We were hoping to help students who needed extra help to, you know, succeed and flourish in subjects, that the games would help them. But what we found was that students who were already successful were even more successful after using games. And so, you know, it's a field with many, many different places to explore still. It's still very young, and so we hold this conference to explore it.
Yeah. I would love to talk more about all these and other things, but we had to use up, I ended up using up the first half hour, and we've now been chatting for 20 minutes, and we want to hear you read.
Absolutely.
And I'm trying to get the computer that will let us play that particular piece of music going and ain't doing it, so I'm going to be working on that while you're reading. Do you need a break before we read, or
I'm ready to roll.
We? I don't know about we. Okay, fine. So is there any, it's a short story, is there any talk up that you need to do, or do we just go in cold?
I think we go in.
Okay, excellent. Oh, and you won't mind that I take some Instagrams of you. My God, why is my phone so hot? Physically. So let me just again mention that this is WBAI in New York City. You're listening to Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and with me, my guest, Carlos Hernandez. And now the mic is yours.
And the story is called Fantasy Impromptu Number 4 in C-sharp minor, Opus 66. This isn't an ordinary piano. This is the infamous Bösendorfer Imperial Concertgram that Vaclav Balusek had custom-built for his comeback at Carnegie Hall. One of the first things you'll notice is that it has 9 extra keys, 5 whole tones and 4 half tones beyond the lowest A of an 88-key piano. All the extra keys are black. I was fascinated by them when I first saw them 15 years ago, and I'm even more fascinated now. They're the bad boys of the piano key world, the kind of piano keys my dad would never let me date in high school. They whisper to me, in the way only inanimate objects can sweet-talk the insane, "Play us, and you will evoke sounds so forbidden, your very soul will thrum." Like everyone, I want my soul to thrum. I run my long nails over the keys like I'm scratching the back of a lover. But playing Balasek's piano uninvited would be unforgivably rude. I'm here at the home of the Balaseks in Coral Gables. Consuela, Vaclav's formidable lawyer wife, is being a proper Cuban host and fetching cafecitos for us, which is how I ended up alone with the piano in the mansion's conservatory. I remind myself that you don't just start playing world-class musicians' priceless instruments, especially not without permission. But I'm still sitting on the bench, petting the keys. "Tickling these ebonies, Gabby," I think to myself, "might be more than bad manners. It might be sexual harassment." I don't really believe that, but the thought helps me come to my senses. I rise from the bench, take a breath, lift the hair off the back of my neck to let it cool. To remove myself from further temptation, I circle the grand piano, taking notes and pictures like a proper reporter should. God, but this piano's a work of art. At first glance, it might pass for a traditional grand, lacquered to a gleaming black and oozing old-world Austro-Hungarian charm. But soon you'll notice the brass and glass touches that a generation ago would have been called steampunk. The scrollwork on the brushed metal hinge of the fallboard, the rectangular portholes in its body framed by verdigris-veined copper, the gorgeous Rube Goldbergian system of pulleys, wheels, and hinges that make up the gloriously over-engineered pedal lyre. It's the kind of grand piano some billionaire arch-geek would order as a showpiece for a living room, more for the eyes than the ears. It's not the instrument I'd expect a world-class pianist like Balasek to commission, and it's really not the vessel I'd expect Balasek to choose as his home for life after death. Oh, did I forget to mention that? Yeah, in case you've been in a coma for the last decade, Vaclav Balasek is dead. At least his body is. But true believers like his wife have maintained that his soul lives on in this beautiful, diabolical piano. Consuela, maiden name Oquendo, returns bearing a silver tray that looks like she lifted it from the cloisters. It's laden with demitasses of espresso and squares of buttered Cuban bread piled up like a carbohydrate Tower of Babel. I thank Consuela and pluck myself a demitasse. She rests the tray on the Mondrian coffee table and sits next to me on the parlor's zebra-striped sofa. Apparently, she gives zeros, beeps, about matching decor. Their oft-photographed home used to be filled with B-movie bric-a-brac back when sci-fi enthusiast Vaclav had a say in matters like these. But even if you believe Vaclav's still alive inside his piano, Consuela's the only one with eyeballs anymore, so I guess she gets to make all the interior design choices in the marriage now. When I don't take any bread, she says, "You have to eat, mi niña. I never would have landed Vaclavito without my curves. Take it from me. Men don't like broomsticks." Ah, the cheerful, feral brusqueness of the Cuban jefa. It's a type I know and have even sought to emulate in many ways. Tireless, cheerful, self-assured women who work 80 hours a week at their jobs, keep their homes impossibly clean, go to church every Sunday, and never, ever let their kids forget who's in charge. They're great, 85% of the time, but they can be a bit, shall we say, peremptory. Like Consuela, they'll tell you to your face you're too skinny, and God help you if they think you're too fat. "Thank you, Señora Balasek," I say, "but I'm vegetarian. Cuban bread is made with lard." Now, The typical Cuban jefa would make a passive-aggressive production of, quote, hiding how much your words have hurt her, and yes, she would take it as a personal attack that you didn't want to eat her store-bought bread. So I start to strategize how I can get back on her good side, when, to my surprise, I see Consuela is embarrassed, apologetic. Ay, mi niña, I'm so sorry, she says. It didn't even occur to me to ask, you being Cuban and all. Yeah, I joke, to show no harm was done. Whoever heard of a Cuban vegetarian? What's next, vegan crocodiles? She laughs politely, and after a moment adds, I shouldn't have called you a broomstick. Forgive me, you're so beautiful. You must have more boyfriends than you know what to do with. Since it's required that I return the compliment, I scan her person for inspiration. Consuela's a 48-year-old salt-and-pepper odalisk who's barely as tall as my chin, and I'm 5'3". Her smile has a practiced guilelessness she probably learned in law school. But she's not dressed for court today. Today she's cultivating the Miami MILF look. She wears a tight floral blouse and a crucified golden Jesus bobs on her cleavage like a castaway on a raft. Her teal pants bell at the bottom, and her ratty house chancletas look like they've been passed down from mother to daughter for 5 generations. I've seen Cuban women dress like this all my life, and genetics guarantee that I someday, too, will dress exactly like this, though I'll draw the line at the crucifix. Me, I say. What about you? You're beautiful, rich, and single. You're one of the most eligible bachelorettes in Miami. I sip a little cafecito and watch for her reaction. She smiles and gives me an I see what you did there look. I'm still married, mi vida. Not according to the law. The law has declared Balusek dead. The law is slow to change. It will come around eventually. Who knows how many lawsuits it will take, but eventually the courts will recognize what has happened to Vaclavito and people like him. Which is what, exactly? There's a little melancholy in the way she tilts her head. Then she says, he moved. I let my eyebrows speak before I do. Moved? As in out of his own flesh? Exactly. His mind persists. He just emigrated out of his former body and into the inural. Emigrating out of your own body sounds to me like a pretty good definition of death. Only if you don't have somewhere else to go, she says. And then her gaze guides me to the piano. After a moment, she asks, do you believe people have souls, Gabby? I never lie during an interview, even when I know my answer may cost me greatly. I suck through my teeth, but tell the truth. No, sorry. Consuela smiles, stands, and offers me her hand. In 10 minutes, you're going to wish you had said, not yet. Before we sit on the piano bench, Consuela helps me into a black leather jacket with built-in gloves. It's 4 sizes too big, but even so, I can feel it's actually an exoskeleton of the python rib variety. A concatenated series of metal rings reside within the jacket's metal arms and fingers. Consuela fastens me into it from behind and adjusts the arm length so that it fits me. Kind of. She can't help but laugh. Oh, Gabby, she says, you look so cute. Like a girl playing dress-up in her poppy's biker clothes. She unceremoniously plants me on the bench. Right thumb on middle C, left pinky on the C sharp, an octave lower, she says. I place my hands on the keys as instructed. The inural that imaged Balusek's mind and let him keep performing years after it should have been possible has been fitted into this piano. It's about to connect wirelessly to this jacket. It's a little freaky. I keep my hands on the piano keys but turn to face Consuela. She pats my shoulder and says, this is going to be fun. Relax. The most unrelaxing thing a person can say. While I am still looking at Consuela, the exo makes my left thumb and pinky play a two-note chord, C-sharp and G-sharp. I turn to look at my hands. Well, hello, Mr. Balusek, I exclaim. I really do exclaim, embarrassingly, fangirlishly. The exoskeleton is not nearly as powerful as I thought it would be. I could resist it if I wanted to. The glove holds the cord for a melancholy second, then leaps, the left thumb landing on C-sharp, the pinky on the G-sharp below it. I watch, amazed, as the left glove starts an arpeggio, slowly at first, but quickly gaining speed. A blink later, my fingers are moving faster than I can move them myself. The right glove transforms itself into a fairy ballerina who leaps and runs over the keys, leaving a contrail of dulcet music in her wake. I am not making this music happen, but every time the glove strikes a key, the music shoots up my fingers and passes into my body just as if I were playing this piece myself. It's so pleasurable and enchanting to feel the music course through me that I forget for a moment to hear it. So I remind myself to listen as well as feel. The piece reminds me of the ad hoc soundtracks pianists of yore would play to accompany silent movies. The black and white scene the music describes is one of peril, pursuit, combat, a runaway locomotive, a showdown at high noon, pirates battling for control of a wave-pitched ship. My fingers race down the length of the keys. The music reaches a climax that reminds me of a car tumbling down a hillside. Will Bonnie and Clyde escape the V8 Ford before it explodes? They do, because the music shifts now to a love story. We see the lovers from behind. They sit on the shore, he wearing a top hat and tailed tuxedo, she in a glistering silver gown and tiara, holding hands and watching waves climb up the shore. There is nothing so beautiful in the world as the oversized moon of a silent movie. It grows a face suddenly and winks at them, but they're too in love to notice. They turn from the ocean and face one another. They lean in, closing the distance between their lips. They almost kiss. But the music shifts back to the rollicking, riotous fairy gambols where we started. Again the melody grows ominous. Again I am falling right to left down the length of the keyboard. Lucifer cast from heaven and plummeting through the firmament until he finally, with terrible impact, crashes into hell. But this time a humble coda rises up, murmuring. One hand mumbles out a pianissimo arpeggio as the other dolefully hearkens us back to the earlier love story. Only this time, love is over, never to return. Love is Ophelia drowned, Samson casting one last pleading look at Delilah, Eurydice reaching after Orpheus as she's pulled back into the underworld. All that remains of that great passion is a memory that is even now fading, fading. Then the music stops, and even the memory of love evanesces into nothingness. The jacket goes limp, my arms drop dead, and slap against my legs. I didn't do a lick of work. The exo did everything, but I'm exhausted, breathless, tousled. I'm simultaneously euphoric and heartbroken. I finally understand what Aristotle meant by catharsis. I turn around to face Consuela. She smiles and shrugs and says, "Now you know Vaclavito. Down to his soul." The piece Vaclav played was Chopin's Fantasy Impromptu No. 4 in C-sharp minor, Opus 66, a devilishly difficult composition that has become one of Chopin's most performed works and a kind of rite of passage for piano virtuosos the world over. But even a player piano could be programmed to play that composition flawlessly, if lifelessly. There was only one way to verify that this wasn't just a robotic recording. Vaclav would have to play it again, with me still wearing the jacket, and he would have to play it differently. Which he does. The second time around, Vaclav plays it more athletically, less dolorously. I learned later that this is the way most journeymen play it. It's so challenging to perform that merely getting through it is an accomplishment. And so many pianists end up treating it as a showcase for their technical prowess. Yet even here, there are millisecond delays and dynamic changes that carry from the first performance to the second. Now that I've lived inside of Vaclav's style, I can identify some of its qualities through the way he uses me to apply pressure to the piano keys. I feel I am starting to get to know him. Vaclav Balasek has shared a little bit of his very qualia with me. That's quite an achievement. Normally, you can't even get inside someone's qualia when they're alive, and Balasek is dead. And I don't just mean legally dead. You won't catch any of the major inural manufacturers claiming they can give your mind a new home after your body dies. They never, never use the term for them that movies and the media throw around, which is cyber reliquary. An inural, they will tell you, is merely a cognitive prosthetic implanted into the brain to help those who have suffered debilitating brain disorders. Like any prosthetic, it's custom-built for the individual. Epileptics get a different inural than those who have suffered a traumatic brain injury, for instance. Those with advanced Alzheimer's get a different one altogether. There are common elements, of course. There's always, for instance, an AI that, like an eager infant, learns to mimic the patient's brain synapse by synapse. Over time, the AI's thinking acquires an uncanny similarity to the patient's. After a training period that can last for months or even years, the inural has essentially become an artificial ganglion that provides the patient's brain with supplementary memory recall and cognitive power. The effects can be positively transformative, as they were for Balasek. I was 14 when he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. His illness was worthy of global sorrow. The world's most beloved living pianist would all too soon lose his ability to play. The media characterized it as a fate worse than death. He would live to see his gift, his life's work, fall to ruins before him day to day. That was bad enough. But for millions of teenage girls like me, for whom Balasek was a particular kind of celebrity crush, not muscular, not macho, but artistic, intellectual, and adorably geeky, it was our first taste of life's cruelty. In the post-diagnosis interviews that followed, Vaclav, holding hands with his wife Consuela, whom I hated back then with unbridled jealousy, vowed to fight the disease. He was a famous proponent of science and futurism. Over the years, he donated millions to the SENS Research Foundation to support a cure for aging. He made me believe he could win. By the time I was a sophomore in college, Vaclav had disappeared from public life. The disease was worsening more quickly than anticipated and wasn't responding to treatment. He hadn't performed in years, and most assumed he would never perform again. And then, back when I was just starting out as a lowly copy editor at the San Francisco Squint, Carnegie Hall announced that Balasek would perform there one night only. Tickets sold out in seconds. Consuela share some black and white photos of that performance with me. Picture one, a steampunk-inspired Bösendorfer Imperial Concert Grand, yes, the same one, sits on the stage. The piano choice is curious, but perhaps the most unusual thing about the shot is that there's no bench on stage. Picture two, wheelchair-bound Balasek takes the stage, smiling and waving. He's puffy and paunchy. He's aged 1,000 years. But most shocking of all is that his hairline is disrupted by a surgery scar as big as a scarecrow's mouth. Consuela shows me more pictures, but they don't really capture what happened next. Vaclav rolled up to the piano, he folded his hands in his laps, and never moved them again until the performance was over. He played the grand piano with his mind. Specifically, he played the grand piano with the inural he'd had installed and the wireless connection built into the Bösendorfer. His performance consisted of works he had commissioned from promising young composers for this occasion. Consuela tells me the commissions were her idea as a way to prove that the performances were really being given by Balasek. But before playing each work, the audience saw a video interview of each composer. The composers spoke of their intentions of the piece, the process of composition, the inspiration, but mostly they talked up Balasek as they rehearsed the work at his Coral Gables home. The audience watched as Balasek in his wheelchair in front of the Bösendorfer would play a portion of the piece with his mind, then consult with the properly awed composer about it, then try again. There was laughing, jokes, and moments of dignified awe as the young composers watched Balasek move the idea he had formed about their music from his mind directly into the piano. My favorite of the composers, Cynthia Gazon, put it this way. He fired the middleman, the hands. He can perform now without having to navigate the cumbersome bureaucracy of the body. It may be the purest music that has ever existed. That one-night engagement at Carnegie Hall turned into a world tour, I say to Consuela. I'm still in the jacket, still on the piano bench, still catching my breath from my second impromptu fantasy with Vaclav. 130 shows in 37 countries, Consuela, sitting in a chair to my left, says wistfully. She's traded the cafecito for a Malbec I can smell from here. Playing works no other pianist could play, I prompt, and she smiles. Vaclavito was no longer limited to two hands and 2 feet. He could play duets by himself. He commissioned over 24 works that would be impossible for any other person alive to play. The 97-note smash that ends Gazon's Singularity Sonata is still considered one of the defining moments of 21st-century music. I ask for a little of that fantastic-smelling Malbec, but when she offers to get it for me, I get up, grab a glass from the wine rack, and pour it myself. Then I carry the bottle over to Consuela. As I'm refilling hers, I say, "Lots of people were never convinced. They thought the performances were pre-recorded, that this was all a big money-making ploy, a last grab at fame." Consuela gives me a you-ain't-kidding look. "Because how could you prove it at the end of the day?" she complains. "We were using the most advanced cybernetic technology in the world. It's not like you could just lift the inaugural's, quote, hood and let people see for themselves how it worked." And then when Balasek died, she stops me short, "He didn't die." Sorry. When his physical body could only be sustained through life support, the attacks became more vicious. That's when the media turned on you. I could take it, because I knew the truth. And she completes the thought the way Cubans often do with an attempt at aphorism. When you have truth on your side, you have nothing to fear. They called you a ghoul. They said you were using your dead husband to make yourself rich. Consuela smiles and shakes her head like she's dealing with a child. She contemplates her wine for a moment, then says, "He could still play the piano there from the hospital bed. All those fancy machines were saying he was dead, but then I would say, 'Vaclavito, would you play Moonlight Sonata for me?' And then the Bösendorfer would immediately start to play it. There wasn't a doctor or nurse who would pull the plug while he could still play the piano. So it fell to me. But I wasn't going to rush anything. I waited until I was sure his migration was complete. And when it was, I had the life support turned off, and I was right, as you now know, Gabby." I sit at the bench again. I drink half my wine, then set it down on a side table. I'm still punchy from the aesthetic tidal wave that was Vaclav performing through me, and the Malbecs making me tipsy in the more traditional way. I'm getting a little loose, a little unprofessional. I exhale with unmastered longing and say, "Yeah, if only everyone could wear this jacket just for a little while." Consuela leans forward. "So you believe me? You know that Vaclav is still inside, still alive." I tell her the truth. Damn it. "No, I think Balasek is dead. I wish I could give you another answer." There's something leonine in the way Consuela is looking at me. I feel like I'm walking into one of her lawyerly traps, but for the life of me, I can't see what it is, and she doesn't tip her hand just yet. Innocent as a telenovela ingenue, she asks, "But what about the music you just played?" I sigh. "People have been leaving behind huge chunks of themselves after death for eons, Consuela. In their diaries and paintings and the notes in their cookbooks and the stories they tell their children. The inaugural is the latest in a long line of media that help us capture some bit of who we were when we were alive and give it to the future. It's the birth of a new art form, one I already love." She frowns skeptically. "That's it. My husband is art to you. I don't back down. Art makes life make sense. Art is a dead thing trying to tell the living how to live. There's an edge there. But again, I can't tell if it's real or just some manufactured anger required from some larger scheme of hers. Only one way to find out. I pick up my wine again and say, look, I know you really believe Balasek's soul resides in the Inural, and I don't want to insult you. But you've gone to court and pled your case and lost. You famously consulted with the Catholic Church on the matter, and Cardinal Bianchi's Commission on Cognitive Prostheses was clear on the matter. Inurals are wonderful, but they're not human. So the law and the church agree. Whatever Vaclav's Inural has retained for us, it's not his soul. The Malbec's almost kicked, but Consuela stops refilling hers to offer me a little. I say no, and she tips the rest of her bottle into her glass. What if they're wrong? She says to me, it's not really a question. The state and the church have changed their minds many, many times. What if 300 years from now they decide, actually, yes, Inurals are alive, sorry for any inconvenience. Well, I say, assuming proper maintenance, Vaclav will still be around to hear that. So that's something. Yes, but what? What does it mean if Vaclav is still here 300 years from now? Consuela's urgent, eager. I'm getting increasingly leery of her. I don't know, I say noncommittally. She peers at me, smiles a little. Her face decides something. She gets up and leaves the room. When she returns a half minute later, she has a chrome disc the size of a frisbee in her hand. Do you know what this is? She asks, and when I shake my head, this is a neodymium rare earth magnet. Super strong. I had to get special permission to buy one this big. I don't say anything. I watch. Will you sit on the sofa for a moment? She says sweetly. I move from the piano bench to the sofa. She puts the magnet on the floor and moves the piano bench out of the way. Then she slips out of her chancletas and gets on her knees and takes the magnet in both hands like a steering wheel. She knee-walks over to the piano. I can see the magnet is already pulling itself toward the piano. She has to fight it. She hugs the magnet to her chest, lies on her back, and scoots herself underneath the Bösendorfer. What are you doing? I ask vaguely, wine in hand. She looks at me. I'd been so busy watching her antics with the magnet that I'd neglected her face. Tears stream out of her eyes. This is why I brought you here, she says. Then she lifts the magnet upwards, and the magnet launches itself into the piano. The jacket squeezes me so forcefully I gasp. I can't inhale. This is what a python attack must feel like. I am about to panic when the jacket slowly slackens its grip. Its strength fades. Then it's completely powerless. Consuela, still on her back under the piano, sobs into her hands. My addled brain slowly assembles a kind of sense of what just happened. My mouth understands before any other part of me because before realization has fully dawned in my mind, I can hear myself saying, no, oh God, no, 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 oh, oh God, please, no. Almost a month after my interview with Consuela, Leniquia Yancey, my editor at The Squint, comes up to my desk with a manila envelope. Mail call, she cheerily chimes. If you're thinking it's weird for an editor to bring a reporter her mail, you're right. Leniquia has been checking in with me several times a day since that interview because, frankly, I've been a wreck. Useless at work and experiencing random panic attacks a few times a week. Every night, I dream of being crushed to death. I smile at Leniquia. You're a good friend. You don't have to bring me my mail every day. Leniquia is constitutionally incapable of pessimism, so whenever her face grows solemn the way it has now, it's cause for worry. This time I really had to, she says. It's from Consuela Balusek. The Squint is mostly a wall-less workspace where snoopy reporter types spend all day overhearing each other's beep. I look around, and yes, everyone's pretending not to look. Can we do this in your office? I ask Leniquia. A minute later, we're in her office.
You open it, I say to her.
She grabs a letter opener and starts slicing open the envelope. It's clean, by the way, she says. I had her guys check it.
I make a WTF face. Consuela wouldn't try to kill us.
She stops opening the letter to look at me incredulously.
After what that crazy bitch did, erasing her husband right in front of you?
She thought she was freeing his soul. Her affect flattens. That is pure bull. Something I can't say on the radio. She didn't think his soul was really in there. She just wanted the publicity. Think about how famous she is now. This was all part of her big plan. This is an old fight between Laniquia and me. I take my traditional tack, mocking her. You've been in San Francisco too long amongst the godless liberals. You've forgotten that there are radically different worldviews out there. Consuela's actions are totally consistent.
They are. My therapist and I have been over it several times.
If you believe in a human soul and in a Catholic heaven and that your husband's soul resides in an inner, then QED, you have prevented your husband from entering into an afterlife of bliss for your own mortal, selfish reasons. After much soul searching, she decided she had to erase Balasek publicly in front of a reporter to show the world the pitfalls of that thinking. Immortals never get to go to heaven. They're destined to an eternal hell on earth.
There is no way a woman of her intelligence and education could possibly believe that, Laniquia insists, arms crossed. All I would need is a week with Laniquia in Miami to prove her wrong. But we've reached our traditional impasse.
Are you going to open the letter, I ask her?
She smiles and shakes her head clear. Almost forgot. She finishes cutting through the top and blows open the envelope. From it, she extracts a picture and a note. We look at the picture together. It's a photograph of Consuela and Guy Savouter, chair of the Board of Regents for the Smithsonian Institution. They're wearing expensive suits and are sitting on a piano bench, hands on knees. Behind them is a 97-key Bösendorfer Imperial Concert Grand. I grab the note. Dear Gabby, I read aloud. I've had Vaclavito's backup inural installed in the Bösendorfer and donated it to the Smithsonian. You'll be receiving an invitation for its debut. I hope by then you will have forgiven me. Please come. Que Dios te bendiga y proteja, Consuela. Laniquia's mouth hangs open for a good 5 seconds. Finally, all she can manage is,
the bitch had a backup?
But I understand completely. I can't get over the validity of her logic, so perfectly consistent. A soul can't be mechanically reproduced, goes Consuela's thinking. By definition, a soul is singular. So when they made a backup copy of the inural, they didn't copy Vaclav's soul, just his mind. In her eyes, she sent her husband to heaven by destroying the original inural. In the meantime, she's donated the soulless backup to the Smithsonian, thus preserving his art on Earth forever.
Inural ex machina, I say to the piece of paper in my hand. And breathe.
Been listening to and are listening to Fantasy Impromptu 66. This one is by Chopin. That one is by Carlos Hernandez. That is just, what a wonderful story. I mean, funny, sad, upsetting, hilarious, fascinating, too, in terms of its scope.
it's the sort of story, you know, I try to write, you know, that tries to do all the things, you know. Oftentimes things will, you know, begin with a kind of question with me about, you know, well, you know, let's say that, you know, the singularity happens and we are able to migrate consciousnesses into other kinds of devices. What are going to be the consequences there? And, you know, I think if you are Catholic, you're going to have to do some real soul searching in a very literal kind of way. To figure out if you actually want to do that, you know?
A Google engine for souls.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I think one of the things I was thinking with the story was, you know, that sometimes we don't die all at once. You know, sometimes we die by degrees. I think this is a point that Geoffrey Eugenides made in Middlesex. But, you know, that, you know, we can fall apart by pieces, you know, and thinking about like what qualia is and what a soul is, you know, and those sorts of things becomes a very difficult and very sad sort of prospect. And so, you know, I thought I would bring that sort of idea to bear with this idea of the singularity and what we do with it, with somebody who's absolutely in love with music and can do more with this kind of tool in some way. But then, you know, sort of like what is the legacy? What is the relic that's left behind, you know, when that person's body fails in at least what we would think of failure in the traditional sense?
Yeah. No, it's just it works so well, and it's brilliant. It's brilliant.
Such a wonderful piece. We by the way, we've been having a running single person play-by-play commentary on your show this morning.
Oh.
From CSE Cooney.
Excellent.
And she will be reading with you. She has a new novel out called Bone Swans.
It's a collection of novellas, actually.
Oh,
and so,
okay. I haven't read it yet, Mike Allen.
but it's The Bone Swans of Amandale, which is the...
I missed her reading it. She was a KGB.
She was a KGB last month.
Yeah, last month.
Right, but...
But
Bone Swans of Amandale is now available, free to read. Mike Allen just put it out because I think it's eligible. It's Nebula eligible and things like that. So, you know, and it, you know, I know it's gotten a few votes and stuff. So I think he wants to make it available.
So is it publicly
available? Yeah, it should be publicly available. I think as of today. Yeah. But I think he just made it available to the world. So,
okay. Well,
yeah.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
But more importantly, available to the world is your new collection of stories.
So, yeah, January 25th is the official release. You can pre-order now. But on the 25th, they will be whisking their way around the world and getting it to people's hands finally. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, and the full title again?
Is The Assimilated Cuban's Guide to Quantum Santeria. I also wanted to say that on February 7th at the New Yorkans Poets Cafe, I'm going to have a release
party. Yes, I will certainly be there.
Yeah, 6 to 8.
I was going to be at the last one, but it didn't happen.
No, I know.
Copies there.
Yeah, you know, just the tribulations of publishing. So, but February 7th, you know, and so hoping some people will come out and, you know, we'll have books there that I'll sign and, you know, I'll read at that point and we'll have a good time.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to figure out how to make a good quantum Santeria punch. And so,
ooh,
you know.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've got some very smart mixologists out there helping me out though. So hopefully I'll have something tasty by then.
Okay. Very good. Yeah. Liquor, I know, punches not quite as much.
Well, you know, it's like Kool-Aid and liquor, right?
The downside of being a diabetic, but fresh fruit, uh-huh. All I've got to say.
Okay.
You know, forget that Kool-Aid stuff unless you're looking for something that's been added to it. So, again, my guest has been Carlos Hernandez. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We have to do this way more often if we have to record. Ms. Cooney, Claire Cooney, you don't get off the hook when you come to New York, and we'll be reading with Carlos Hernandez and Barbara Krasnoff and 5 other people for the launch of Clockwork Phoenix on April 5th.
On April 5th,
yeah. In this very building.
Yay!
At 388 Atlantic Avenue. And Wow, that just so wonderful.
Well, thank you for having me here. It's, you know, absolute honor to be here and, you know, help me get the word out about the collection that's coming.
Absolutely. And stay tuned, everybody, for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way as he gets those CDs. You gotta go digital, man. As he gets those CDs out on the table and brings us a miraculous music and wonderful talk. And everybody, be very good to each other. It's been a difficult month for those who love their art. And we go out there with not our usual Steel Eyes band, but Journey of the Sorcerer by Glenn Frey, who also passed away this month. And it's the Eagles, but hey, it's Glenn Frey there. And of course, for science fiction people, you probably know it as the theme to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So, don't panic and stay tuned. And again, thank you, Carlos Hernandez.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back next week with Rob Cameron and a slew of podcasters. Enjoy.
put on hold. The bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pig lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. And drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Pile up. Driver's not your business, and them quick for spoil up. Hey, well done, well done, Mr. Politician Man. You done a wonderful job of tear down with country demolition, man. Sibili bang, well done, well done, Mr. Politician Man. You done such a great job selling out with country with your business plan. Well, you forget a round of applause for all the work you're doing. Decisions where you make will left the country in a ruins, yo. Strictly personal gain you're pursuing, but the tax rate higher than the planes where you're flew in. We gon' make your deal with the IMF, knowing on a Fox night, none of sugar cane left. The hotels and the beaches, the Spanish them go screeching. Me no know how you read, but all my office say is well done. Well done, Mr. Politician Man. You done a wonderful job of tear down with country demolition, man. Skibbly bang, well done, Mr. Politician Man. You done such a great job selling out with country with your business plan.
And what kind of plan?
Which is to keep poverty and unemployment on the rise. Corruption and not to mention the lies. Election and when the tension arise. So your Bible can talk and not to mention the fries. Anything to secure your vote. And then you rob the people to secure your vote. We go up. Go Thailand where the Chinese own. No, Jamaica is a Chinese loan. But tell you well done. Well done, Mr. Politician Man.
How are you treating
so? You done a wonderful job of tear down with country demolition, man. Well done, well done, well done, Miss Politician Lady. You done such a great job selling out the country and you still not pay with. But still if inflation was a test, you would not get A plus. So when me met the US, the exchange rate buff. Got the dollar getting deeper. And I stole a life, did it with a cheaper. But a JPS, you pray for keep ya Ebenezer. So you're screwed from the ghetto people. Where you starve and every year you buy a better vehicle. The things you do are beat with bad, but still you manage to keep your job. So me, I tell you, well done, well done, Mr. Politician Man.
Take
for
money on your
gun. You done a wonderful job of tear down with country demolition, man. You believe it, well done, Miss Politician Lady. You done such a great job selling out your country. But be like Humpty Dumpty now.
Jamaica Pyramid speaks out.
Congratulate me now. You have to give some effort, you know. Yeah man, enough things don't go on it, you know. But you them see it still, so give thanks. Yeah man, gangster, kabaka.
The Ruddick and Scorcher for this week, produced by Damian Marley, is called Well Done.
I. At the bank of the beautiful river, in your journey.